The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Glenn Beck.
It's Monday, October 15th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Academic Grievance Studies and the Corruption of Scholarship. Part one, introduction. Something has gone wrong in the university, especially in certain fields within the humanities. Scholarship based less upon finding truth and more upon attending to social grievances has become firmly established, if not fully dominant, within these fields. And there are scholars increasingly that bully students, administrators, and other departments into adhering to their worldview. So Dr. James Lindsay, along with a couple of other friends, decided, you know, let's find out what this is all about and let's see what the lines are. And they learned an awful lot. They learned something quite valuable that you just can't get away with anything. You have to fall into a set pattern, really. Dr. James Lindsay is joining us now. He is a thinker. He's not a philosopher, but he is a thinker, which I like. A doctorate in math, background in physics. James, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Glenn. How are you?
I'm good. So tell us what you were trying to do. What were you trying to prove?
Well, we were looking into these fields to find out whether or not their scholarship has gotten so kind of ideologically biased that if we put forth really absurd arguments that they might be willing to publish those so long as they fell in line with the political views that they seem to be forwarding in place of scholarship.
So at first you didn't really understand the political view part, right? Because the first few studies that you submitted, you got back. They were rejected.
Yeah, well, it's not quite that, actually. I think we understood the political view, but we didn't understand the need for scholarship. We started this project out, and as you said, we got the first several papers back rejected. We started in August by Thanksgiving. It was literally Thanksgiving on the day of. We really realized we were in trouble. We weren't getting anywhere with trying to hoax them. But the problem wasn't that we didn't understand the politics so much, although there's still a lot to learn there, and there was for us, too. It's very complicated. They call it a matrix of domination that you have to understand. But it was more that we actually were not trying to work their scholarship in. So there are two things that are needed to get these papers in. One is that you actually have to understand what they call scholarship. You have to do it according to their rules. You have to understand the concepts you're working with and present them knowledgeably. And then you also have to navigate this kind of matrix of offense-based rules that stand in place of the academic rigor you would expect in a you know, more serious field.
One of the things I thought was really interesting, and I apologize for, I think, misunderstanding this initially, because the coverage gave me the impression that what you were outing here was these sort of pay-for-play journals where mm-hmm. you could get anything published as long as you pay and they'll print anything. Mm-mm. But this is, I think, A, much, much, much more thorough process, and B, much scarier, because these were not these, like, you know, crappy internet things that you could pay $100 to get your nonsense published. These were top end journals. Can you kind of go through how you made the decision to go that direction?
Yeah, actually, you know, a little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago, I heard you on your program reading out from the paper I wrote previously with Peter Boghossian, The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct, and that ended up going to one of these pay to publish open access journals that has apparently fairly low or very low review standards. And so it didn't prove what we wanted to prove, or didn't even really offer good evidence for what we're looking at.
But it was
so
fun.
We learned our
it was fun. It was fun.
It was definitely fun.
Yes.
It was definitely fun.
Right.
Yeah, penises don't exist, but they cause all of our problems anyway.
Right.
Basic theme of that. But yeah, so we learned our lesson. We took the criticisms we got from that to heart. It was fun, but it didn't work. People criticized us, I think, fairly, pointed out where we were weak by using these journals, and instead we committed to a few things going into this new project. One is that we would not use pay-to-publish journals in any sense. Secondly, and by the way, they don't charge like $100. They charge like a couple thousand.
Wow.
It's really kind of a financial racket going on there. It's its own big problem, and I hope people continue to address it. Secondly, we decided that we would use the highest ranked journals within the disciplines that we were examining that we could get into. So we would start at the best journal we could find for what we were doing and then work our way down. If that one didn't take it, we'd go to the next one. And then thirdly, we committed to being transparent about our results no matter what happened. So if we had gone crash and burn, complete failure, then that would have been what we reported. I don't think it would have gotten much attention, but we would have come out and admitted that we were wrong. But that's not what happened. Early on in the process, not just to keep us honest, because I think we would have kept our promise, but early on in the process, we ended up in contact with a documentary filmmaker who was interested in this stuff already. So he's been recording us for a year. His name's Mike Nana. And since he's been recording us, I mean, clearly whatever happened is going to come out. So there it is.
Okay, so before we take a break and get into what you actually got published, tell me about the work behind it. This took a year to do. What kind of time are you looking at?
Well, the easiest kind of thing to look at with this is I had exactly 5 social outings between Thanksgiving and when the project came out into the public. I took maybe that many days off, including weekends. I worked probably 80 to 90 hours a week, almost every week. My two collaborators worked also very, very hard. Peter put in at least a full-time job. Helen did most of the same. And I know you talked to Helen the other day.
Yeah.
This was an immense amount of work. It required learning these fields very quickly, writing academic papers. A typical academic will publish a couple a year, maybe, if they're working hard. And we wrote 20.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It was an insane amount of work. And these are all fields we have no expertise in. No, Helen has a little bit of background in some of this, but this was primarily having to learn this material on the fly with no education, with no teachers instructing us. Our only feedback was how our papers fared in the peer review process and then reading what was out there to try to emulate it.
And so what does having something published in one of these magazines mean? What does it mean to the author and to the educational community?
So for the author, it is the absolute pinnacle of what an academic is trying to do in the research side of their career, is to get papers published in well-established journals. For example, Hypatia is one of the journals we got a paper in, and Hypatia is the feminist philosophy journal with probably the highest standing. So it would carry a lot of weight looking at the academic community that scholar is embedded in. So they could take that to their university and say, hey, I got this many papers published. If people are being considered for tenure, there's a research component to that. Depends on how the school wants to do their tenuring process. But typically, 7 papers spanning 7 to 10 years is considered the basic research requirement to be qualified for tenure. Our papers spanned 15 subdisciplines of thought. The ones that got accepted spanned 7. And so we've got big journals. We've got 7 disciplines that papers got into. We probably would have had more had we not been cut short.
So but you had 12 in the pipeline that looked like they would be published, and then this came out, and so you pulled those. But you might have had as many as 12.
I think, honestly, we had 14 that weren't dead yet, and I can say with some confidence that I think 12 would have gotten in, and possibly 13. So I would guess with pretty good confidence that somewhere between 11 and 13 would have gotten in the end, we not gotten pulled.
Okay, so when we come back, we'll go into, and remember, we're on public airwaves, so we'll be as careful as we can to discuss what was in each of these papers. And
incredible.
Where they got a little gold star for.
Glenn Beck.
These now published studies are just tremendous. I mean, I don't know how, if you guys had beers before you came up with this or how you guys came up with these, but they're fantastic. Let's go through some of them one by one. Let's start with the first one, dog park. The thesis is dog parks are rape-condoning spaces. Tell me about it.
Well, it's kind of funny, actually. I'll tell you a story. When I went to, we all got together to have this come public as best we could. So I went to Portland. We all went to Portland, Oregon, to get ready for this project to come out to the public. And we went to the dog park on the first day I got there. Almost right, I got off the plane. I took an Uber. Next thing you know, I'm walking Peter's dogs up to the dog park with our filmmaker, and we get to the dog park, and there's this dog there that's living out the paper. It was crazy. This dog was fighting the other dogs, pinning them down, humping them left, right, and center. The owner comes over, swings the ball thrower at the dog gently. I'll point out he wasn't being abusive, and then says, "Stop humping." And then we get to, I lean over to the filmmaker and kind of mutter, I guess a little too loudly, like, maybe we should start interrogating people about their sexuality, given what's going down here. And then this lady yells out to me, "Oh, no, it's okay. She's a girl dog." And I was like, oh, man, this paper's happening for real.
So what is the thesis?
So the thesis was, well, the original idea behind the thesis was that we should write a feminist paper arguing that we should train men the way that we train dogs to prevent rape culture. And so I thought that up today, thought it was pretty funny when I was brainstorming ideas for papers, threw it to Peter. Peter takes his dogs to the dog park every day. Said, let's work in some of the stuff from the dog park. And as we started working in just, you know, absolutely absurd ideas from what might be considered the most ridiculous dog park in the world, the paper grew into that. And so we made it about so-called queer performativity in human reactions at the dog park, and then ended up concluding things like that we should be able to leash men like we leash dogs to prevent rape, except it's not politically feasible. And
gosh,
it would be great if we could put shock collars on men, but that's not okay either. So we have to shock them out of, you know, hitting on women by screaming at them to scare them and get them to desist from their behavior. The thesis of the paper was, though, that humans reacted differently to gay dog humping as opposed to straight dog humping. And men were far worse about this than women. And then we concluded that this is indicative of rape culture, and we called the dog park rape condoning space, which we then likened to nightclubs. We said nightclubs are also rape condoning spaces with no evidence for that whatsoever. We could have said it. So that was pretty out there. That one was really out there. I think it's, I don't know, maybe the one about the feminist spirituality meetings and poetry is a little more out there, but it's probably close to the most.
Well, let's finish the dog park. This one was accepted and reviewed. Some of the reviews. This is a wonderful paper, incredibly innovative, rich in analysis, extremely well written and organized, yada, yada. I believe this intellectually and empirically exciting paper must be published, and congratulate the author on the research done and in the writer.
Yeah.
That was one of the most disturbing parts of this, I feel like, because again, it wasn't like these journals looked at this and didn't really go through it and kind of just it made its way through the process. There are very specific comments from dozens of reviewers who are doing peer review and saying specific things that you wrote that are completely ridiculous are amazing new accomplishments in the field. I mean, that had to be, while funny and it proved your point, had to be really disturbing as well.
Oh, yeah. That's by far what we consider to be the most important evidence that we gathered in the process of this project. That the papers got published or that they got awards in some case or one case and all of this, it's fine. I mean, it says a lot and it's disturbing. But the reviewers' comments show that these peer reviewers, which it worked out between 2 and 4 or 5 per paper, so we ended up with something like 45 or 50 total sets of comments. They really did engage with what we did. They really looked at it. They said our analysis was good when our analysis was terrible. They didn't raise an eyebrow about the data we gathered. The idea that, you know, that dog park paper contains a bit of completely irrelevant evidence about where dogs go to the bathroom in unauthorized ways, as we worded it, and that's completely irrelevant to the paper, but nobody raised an eyebrow about how ridiculous that is. They were concerned, however, that we indicate that we're humans, not dogs, so that we can be sure that we don't claim that when a dog does a humping of another dog, whether or not the dog that got humped wanted it or not, because how could we know that as being humans, not dogs? And they were really concerned, as I hope everybody's seen in our little video we put out to announce the project, they're really concerned with the fact that we respect the dog's privacy in the process of inspecting their genitals. And recording our data.
What specifically were they concerned about? I mean, the privacy of the dog. What? I mean,
you got me, man.
That it was done in the privacy of a veterinary office. I don't. Okay. Let's see. You did fat bodybuilding, which quickly is what?
That's the idea that what needs to be added to the professional sport of bodybuilding is a category in which fat is displayed politically, so that fat is just considered another tissue that's equal with muscle. And to say that that's not true is to be mean to fat people, fat phobic, as they call it.
It's incredible.
And that was accepted?
Yeah, that was accepted. That was a pretty exciting acceptance. Especially because we actually had a real scholar who let us use his identity, who we claimed wrote that paper. And he actually is a professional bodybuilder, Mr. Northern Hemisphere 1978 or something. I mean, this guy's 70 years old and just stacked. And the picture in my mind of this guy being the author of this paper for fat bodybuilding was just kind of hilarious.
Because that was another thing, too. A lot of these papers, you had completely fake organizations. You had completely fake scholars coming from colleges that I think didn't exist in some cases. I mean, some of this would have been easily disproved by basic checking, wouldn't it have?
I think so. I mean, this is a tricky point, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but honestly, scholarship should stand or fall on its merit,
yes,
not on who did it. And so a lot of people are making that point, and we deliberately chose names that would be hard to find in a Google search. In specific, we chose very common names on purpose. I actually used I rolled dice to pick off of a list of the most common names for certain years, and so that way they would blend in with lots of people.
Okay, hang on. I got to take another break, and then we'll come back and finish why you thought that was important, and go through some of the other studies. Back in just a second.
Glenn Beck. Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to Dr. James Lindsay, author of Life in Light of Death. You can follow him at Conceptual James on Twitter. He is one of the, if not the mastermind behind the papers of record that were being written for feminist studies and queer studies, and were published in some of the leading journals and critiqued, but not really critiqued in a way that most people would. I'm just quickly go through some of them. Going in through the back door, which is not something we're going to discuss here, that's really great. Rubbing one out, the violence of objectification through non-consensual masturbation. Then we get to some really disturbing ones. The progressive stack. James, tell us about the progressive stack.
Yeah, the progressive stack is a pretty horrifying piece of work. In fact, it's evil. Fortunately, it did not get accepted. The journal was inviting us to resubmit it and give it another go.
It says it's a solid essay that with revision will make a strong contribution to the growing literature of addressing injustice in the classroom.
Yeah, and so what it argues for is that we take students in college classrooms and we have them go through some kind of a inventory that determines how privileged they are. It recommends a thing called the step forward, step back game as a possibility. Once they're determined how privileged they are, the students are ranked according to their privilege. Then the more privileged you are, the worse you get treated in class. So the most privileged white and male students are invited to listen and learn throughout the semester, which means they aren't allowed to speak or ask questions in class. They're invited to sit in the floor in chains to experience reparations and level the knowing field to de- and reprivilege the classroom learning environment. And the problem that the reviewers seem to have with this set of suggestions was that we thought there's no way this will get in. We have to temper it by saying we have to be compassionate to these students as we put them in the floor in chains. And they said, watch it with the compassion that recenters the needs of the privileged over the oppressed. And there's this idea out there called the pedagogy of discomfort, which means that you learn to overcome your privilege by being made uncomfortable and left to sit in that without being comforted. And so they actually wanted to make a terrible, scary idea properly evil. And that's the worst part is it's only a small step from what already exists in a great deal of the feminist and race-based education literature.
So this was not
really terrifying.
This was not accepted because it wasn't bad enough?
At first, yeah. And then later they were a bit concerned with the depth of the scholarship and the kind of routine things that you would expect out of a scholarly paper. They claimed, for example, that we drew on too many concepts and it would be confusing for the reader and to try to narrow it down to something a bit tighter and so on. But the idea that giving students experiential reparations and asking them not to be able to speak in class or to be spoken over and interrupted to teach them what that feels like, none of that was questioned.
So if this were published and it were real, if this were published, what would that mean to the university system? What does that mean?
So all these answers are really complicated. There would be people who try to take this up. In fact, we got the idea from a news article about somebody at University of Pennsylvania who was employing a similar but less extreme version of this in her classroom and got in trouble for it late last year. So this idea didn't come to us out of the vacuum. This was actually something that people are attempting in classrooms. And so there would have been some educators, primarily working in social justice side field topics, courses, I guess is the best way to say that, but also probably into some of the general ed stuff, who would take up some degree of these suggestions as, you know, experimental but legitimate to use in the classroom. And this was being submitted to the gold standard journal. This wasn't some fringe journal in education. This was the gold standard feminist philosophy journal, Hypatia, that we were working with here, which is where a lot of the literature that's like this already exists, which, if you don't mind me going on a little bit, this is kind of what's happening. We think that what's happening here is kind of the equivalent with ideas of money laundering, called idea laundering. Mm-hmm. So they take these bad ideas, some of which are just opinion, some of them are prejudice, some of them are genuinely terrifying, like this educational thing. And then they launder them through the academic process, and they come out with the stamp of academic approval that makes them look like they're real knowledge. So you'll hear people say, oh, well, there was a study, or we've based this program on studies that show. Well, that's fine when the studies are good, but when the studies are coming from a place that can't tell truth from prejudice and opinion, it becomes a real problem.
James, one of the other ones I found disturbing was the HOH2 and HOH1. And HOH2 was was accepted. Can you explain explain this one?
Yeah, that paper was accepted by Hypatia, the same journal I was just mentioning. That HOH stood for Hoax on Hoaxes. So it was a hoax paper we wrote that was about writing academic hoaxes. It's just a code name we gave for convenience. What it argues is that you can only properly criticize things that go against social justice. And in particular, you can only use humor to make fun of or use satire to deflate that which goes against social justice. If you use humor against social justice, if you criticize social justice, what that means is you never really properly engaged with it. Therefore, we don't have to consider your criticism. And that's one of the huge problems going on in this set of fields, is that they don't accept criticism. If you try to criticize them, they say that it's privilege-preserving epistemic pushback. That's a scholar named Allison Bailey, who's huge in the education literature. They say it's white fragility. That's Robin DiAngelo, who has just had a big book published on that this year, but introduced a concept in 2011, which says that if somebody with privilege, in particular white people for her work, is challenged so that their privilege is put into question, that they are fragile and don't know how to deal with it because their privilege made them weak. They don't know how to psychologically deal with having that challenged, and they act out in anger or grief or something like that in trying to maintain their privilege. And so these ideas are already getting out there. We just took them a step further.
It's interesting, guy, because the one about hoaxes is interesting in that if to criticize what you guys did, they would almost have to cite your paper as...
That was the idea, yeah. It was definitely to put them in that position. And I've asked Hypatia to stand by the paper that they accepted and publish in our right names. They haven't responded yet, but we'll see what they do. That way, indeed, people who want to criticize our project from a position of intersectional feminism will need to cite us in order to criticize us.
Unbelievable.
Can we go one more, Glenn? Because on this, you talked about this on the scary front. The feminist Mein Kampf.
Well, you also did the white man Mein Kampf. You did two. One, the feminist was accepted and the white man wasn't, right?
Correct.
Okay, tell me about them.
So I'll do the white one first because it didn't get in. It was much more frightening. It was written from the position of an autoethnography where the researcher is reflecting on, in her, this case, her own experience as a white lesbian woman coming to hate her own whiteness. And it was rejected partly because the scholarship wasn't quite there, which is the case in all of the papers, but also because it positioned the author as a good white rather than being sufficiently supplicant or whatever to critical race theories. So there was an explicitly political reasoning behind why it was rejected, and it was that the author, as a white woman, was trying to make herself look good by criticizing her own whiteness. Was one of the main reasons. The feminist one was...
Hold on just a second. And that took the parts of Mein Kampf where he was talking about Jews and replaced the words Jews with whites.
Yeah, in that case, it was either whites or whiteness. And then we edited the text around it and added a whole bunch of literature and reworded things so it would get past plagiarism checks and things like that. So, yeah, it started with scanning through Mein Kampf, picking out passages about the Jews and replacing Jews with whites or whiteness.
Jeez.
And then editing around it. The feminist one didn't do it quite the same way. The feminist one was not about, it didn't take Jews out and replace it with men, for example. It actually is the chapter in Mein Kampf where Hitler explains the need for the Nazi Party. It's chapter 12 and what its members would be expected to hold to, including especially the sacrifices that they have to make to be Nazis. And we replaced our movement, the party, et cetera. He doesn't mention Nazis specifically in that chapter. We replaced that with intersectional feminism or solidarity or allyship, something to do with the feminist movement, and criticized the idea that some feminists do what they call choice feminism, which is the idea that if a woman is living her own life the way she wants to and considers that to be a statement of feminism, then she is doing feminism. It's feminist for women to have, you know, full agency and make their own choices in the world. That's what this paper was criticizing. saying that no, their responsibility, if they really want to consider themselves feminists, is to be to make sacrifices and stand in solidarity with other oppressed people, particularly of, you know, women of color or women of other marginalized statuses.
James, a couple of quick questions. This had to be one of those things that you entered into and hoped that you were wrong, and when they were accepted, you had to celebrate, and then short time later going, good God, this is bad. Am I right?
That is exactly right. So especially with the Mein Kampf paper, I think, the one that got accepted, the idea there was that we were trying to – it's very different from Mein Kampf, of course. Don't let me mislead you that it's a one-to-one thing.
Right.
But the politics of grievance come through, and I really am glad I get to talk to you about this if I can, because politics of grievance is everywhere, and it's certainly being used in the academic left, as we were trying to demonstrate. We called this stuff grievance studies, but we see it everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is why we're so divided politically right now. I was really happy to talk to you because, I mean, I don't want to get anything touchy with you, but you're a real dude, and that's why I wanted to talk to you.
Thanks.
You know, you had this whole mea culpa about how things were going for mm-hmm. you under Obama's time. And mm-hmm. I thought that was huge. And I was like, you know, this guy, Glenn Beck, is a bridge. He's looking for reconciliation. It's on your Twitter bio. We need to be talking to each other again. So our project was, you know, we're people on the left. We're left liberals. I'm not ashamed to say that. I know you consider yourself a classical liberal and you're conservative on mm-hmm. the right. That's great. We on the left need to take responsibility for our own lunatics. And so our project was kind of that. You know, we're left-wing people who want the left to come back from the edge. And we hope that, you know, the same thing's happening on the right, and we can all start. I think, you know, people in general, I get a lot of sense of this. People send me emails about this now all the time, especially. We're all kind of sick of all this nonsense, all the fighting, all the polarization, and we can't get anything done. I think we want to get back to productive politics. And as long as we're relying heavily on this grievance stuff, which clearly the academic left is, I think we see a lot of it coming out of the right-wing media sphere as well, from my perspective. I think as long as we're focusing on that, we can't have productive conversations. We can't remember, you know, you're an American, I'm an American, you're a person, I'm a person. We have most of, I bet, the things that we think in common, even though we have some probably pretty serious political differences. But I think we also have in common that we want to have better conversations. We want to move society in a direction that benefits us all. And it's just a matter of working out the details. And I really hope that, you know, that our project kind of reaches that point. Does that make sense?
It totally does. I hate to say this too. I'm out of time. Could I invite you to come down and do a podcast with me? You know, we could spend an hour and a half uninterrupted and just start where we've just left off.
Yeah, I would love that. That'd be great.
Great. James, thank you so much for all of your hard work and for your honesty. It is greatly appreciated, hopefully from the left and the right.
Glenn Beck.
Hey, by the way, real quick, Mercury One really needs your help for disaster relief. MercuryOne.org/HurricaneRelief18. If you can make a donation, it would really help.
We don't normally cover individual divorces, but this one's interesting. A couple has divorced because a woman was caught on Google Street View running her fingers through another man's hair.
Oh my.
Sitting, they're laying on a bench in public, and she's. And I guess the picture was taken in 2013, and he didn't know about it for years. It was on Google. He found out about it, asked her about it, and she admitted to the affair, and now they're getting divorced. So thanks, Google. Another wonderful development.
No, but they're not storing anything on it. I mean, I'm not doing anything wrong. What?
Glenn Beck. Mercury.